Today we are joined by Sophia Stamatopoulou and Jess Ghanem, who comment on a devastating new report authored by Sophia. This report, Costs of War, reviews data gathered in Palestine since October 7th, 2023. In that year alone, the report finds that the United States has spent at least $22.76 billion on military aid to Israel and related U.S. operations in the region. The number of direct deaths, but also so-called indirect deaths, and such a term forces us to project such deaths well into the future due to Israel's massive destruction to the infrastructure and environment necessary to sustain even the barest forms of life, leads this report to claim that, quote, the scale and rapidity of Gaza's destruction is unprecedented, not only in Palestinian history, but in recent global history. Today, we review but a small portion of the information that supports this terrible claim. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Welcome, Sophia and Jess. Thank you for being here to discuss this critically important report. The information is both compelling and difficult to fathom or fully grasp. I thought we could start by asking Sophia about the genesis of this work and maybe discuss the findings that were most significant to her, and then Jess could chime in, and then we could hash it all out in the conversation. So, Sophia, why don't you start?
Yeah, thank you so much for having us here for this conversation. I thought I would tell you a little bit about how the report started and then get into the overall death estimates for Gaza, as well as the pathways to indirect death. I had begun with a piece I wrote for the American Anthropological Association on the state of affairs in terms of Gaza's infrastructure about Israel-Palestine more broadly. And then I was a little bit later approached by the Costs of War Project, which had never actually addressed U.S.-backed military operations led by Israel in the past, even though the Costs of War Project is interested in U.S. spending on military operations across the globe. So I can just say a little bit first about the Costs of War Project. They conduct and publish research about the ongoing consequences of the United States post-9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, as well as the costs of global U.S. military operations and the domestic effects of U.S. military spending. My report came out as a companion report to the U.S. spending in dollar amounts on Israel's military operations and related U.S. operations in the region. That report found that at least $22.76 billion and counting have been spent in the last year by the U.S. supporting Israeli military operations in the region. My report, just anecdotally, was supposed to be a 1 to 3 page overview, but I could not leave it at that as I did the research for this. So it ended up being a standalone report of 25 pages on what they're calling the human toll, using this language of indirect deaths, which we can question and has been questioned by war scholars. The directness, basically, and the indirectness of that has been questioned. So my report was really a compilation of previously published data from international agencies, public health research, and Israeli and Palestinian organizations. And the reason we had to do that work was that there's no central agency that is counting the total number of people who are dying from causes other than traumatic injury in Gaza right now. So we do know that the Gaza Health Ministry is counting those traumatic injuries, and that's where we get the roughly 41 to 43,000 right now that we're hearing direct deaths. But we know, and any war expert will tell you, that the numbers of people killed in any war indirectly are far higher than the traumatic injury deaths. Part of the point in this report was to look at the pathways to indirect death using the costs of war framework, which looks at economic collapse and food insecurity, destruction of infrastructures and the health system, and environmental degradation, which is also to say that what's happening in Gaza is a known set of ripple effects or reverberations that happen in war, which I guess also gets to a point I'd like to make a little bit later, too, which is that Israel knows full well that to bomb infrastructure is to kill people. So just to keep in mind that as we think about questions of intentionality, which were not the focus of this report, we can be quite aware that there is also clarity for anyone practicing war that to bomb a road or a hospital is to cause these indirect deaths. So the other thing I want to highlight from the report before I get into some of the numbers is that it's very clear, again, to everyone working on estimates and the reverberating effects of these forms of destruction, that the death toll in Gaza will continue even if the bombs stop tomorrow. So we can't rest at even going from the ratio of direct to indirect deaths, which is what I'll talk about in a second. We have to imagine that this will last for many years, the ripple effects of destruction into indirect deaths. So something that is extremely shocking, I think, to me, even as someone who follows the war very closely, is that we're looking at numbers that are totally unprecedented, even for U.S.-backed wars across the globe since 9/11. The conservative estimate that's usually used is one direct death to three indirect deaths by war experts, and the highest ratio is one direct death to 25 indirect deaths. The Lancet report, which some of the listeners here might have heard about, came out in June and estimated that from 37,000 traumatic injuries using the one direct to four indirect deaths, which is almost the most conservative estimate, at that point by June, we had 186,000 people already dead in Gaza in total. If we take today's numbers, which is around 42,000 direct deaths, that would bring us to 208,000 people who've been killed this year already in Gaza. And now just to put it in perspective with the U.S.-backed military operations across the world since 9/11, an estimated 3.6 to 3.8 million people have died indirectly in the post-9/11 wars, bringing the total death toll to at least 4.5 to 4.7 million and counting. I'm embarrassed to say that I did not know this number before I did this report and worked with costs of war, that we're talking in the four to five million people that the U.S. has essentially contributed to killing in the last 23 years. If you take an average annual number the U.S. contributes to killing, that's around 200,000 people a year that the U.S. contributes to killing across the globe. And today we have at least 208,000 people dead in Gaza on this extremely small territory. So just to give you a sense of the scale, I think it's important. That's one of the results for me of the report. And as I was thinking about this, I thought, you're at Stanford, David, you two are both in California. That's around 13 times the student population of Stanford University. And then I wanted to say also that if you take the highest ratio that is still within the bounds of what is feasible in a war, so one direct to 25 indirect deaths, we come to over 1,081,000 Palestinians who've been killed already in this war. And that is very helpful for me to remember, because as I watch the news, I hear 93 people killed here, 22 people killed there. And these numbers as standalone events on any given day do not really add up to what we're really seeing unless we can comprehend that scale. So over 1 million Palestinians dead, that's half of Gaza's population, if we go with that estimate, and that's the entire population of San Jose, California. I will say that I'm frustrated by my own instinct to have to compare to people in California. I think one of the things we're seeing that all of us are thinking about, really, who are worried about this, is the total dehumanization of Palestinians, which we know was afoot before, but has really slapped us in the face in the last year. So I don't know if it feels right to you for me to get into the pathways to indirect death now, or I can hold off and tell you a little more about them.
Maybe Jess could react to some of the things that Sophia said about the proportions that we're talking about that are completely absent in the press. And then Sophia can talk more about the indirect pathways.
Yeah, thanks, David. And thanks so much for your work, Sophia. I really think that in reading your report, I think it's both brilliant and really tragic at the same time, because myself, having worked in Palestine, specifically in Gaza, for the last 25 years, in my own area of research, which is on the health consequences of war, occupation, displacement, and the generational impact on people, especially Palestinians, I can tell you that the read of your research tracks really well with my experience on the ground over the last 25 years. And then in addition to that, it really tracks very well in the medical literature, medical research, looking at the health determinants of racism, war, occupation, things like that. So there is a tracking of the impact of your anthropological work in terms of my experience on the ground and other empirical research. And I think really what it does is that it dimensionalizes the sphere of the genocide in a way that is really not well represented in the media at all. Because doing the body count data representation is digestible for the average person, right? But it really belies the reality of the sphere and the dimensionality of the utter destruction to human societies, civil societies, and communities in Palestine, specifically in Gaza right now, that never really gets spoken about in a comprehensive, more dimensional way. Because really what we're talking about, and I think this is where your report is really so brilliant, is that it really dimensionalizes and expands our understanding of the impact of war on communities that goes beyond the body count. And what we know from medical research and what I know from my experience in working on the ground in Gaza is that these wars, these occupations, this settler colonial project that has been on the ground for over 76 years now, affects, impacts, and attacks every aspect of your existence. It just does. And so we know that there is a negative long-term health consequence to just being under occupation. And that Palestinians in Gaza, this is the fifth war that they've experienced since 2005, in addition to a brutal blockade, which has already mitigated the impact of those societies being able to thrive and to grow and to develop. You superimpose a year of a brutal genocide and an extermination of Palestinians in Gaza. Your report is the first report that I'm aware of, because I'm aware of the Lancet report. I'm aware of the report coming from the Gaza Health Ministry. Your report really is the first report to take us down the path of beginning to imagine the long term. And I'm not just talking about the next year or so. I'm talking about the multi-generational impact of this genocide, of this brutality, this destruction of a civil society, of a number of communities, the multi-generational impact that will be with Palestinians for the foreseeable future. This is not just years. This is just not decades. We're talking about a generational impact. I think that the estimate of a million deaths tragically may actually underestimate the generational impact that it could have. Thanks for your work. I hope that it really sparks a more active debate. And I think it does dovetail with some of the other work that we're trying to do in terms of mitigating this harm from a medical and mental health standpoint, because we have to take this on now. We're already thinking about rebuilding, even though we're facing this kind of catastrophic destruction of all aspects of civic society. So I'll stop there because, and David knows this, I obviously have a lot to say, but maybe we could just get the discussion going.
Thank you so much, Jess. Sophia, did you want to talk about the pathways that sort of get us into the finer details of how this is all coming about?
Yeah, I would like to share those because I know not everyone has the time to read a 25-page report. They should, and it's also, it is a brutal thing to witness as you go through those details. But I think just before I get into those, what I didn't talk about in this report, because again, I was working within the costs of war framework. No analysis is partly the name of the game in order to reach policymakers who can't stomach like the word genocide or settler colonialism, but who will be impacted by questions of starvation and numbers in a different way. But I think what you're saying, Jess, is also that even if you rebuild Gaza better than it was before, right, in some kind of utopian scenario where Israel withdraws, Gaza rebuilds, the reverberations would be massive, I think. And when you track basically reverberations on the human body and the human psyche and people's family lives, life is made of in that three-dimensional way that goes far beyond the biological body existing, you really start to imagine those impacts in a different way. So I unfortunately, the report doesn't do that work, but its sort of function is precisely to make
that's
it.
That's what I took from it. That's how possible. Yeah, that's why I thought it was so important, because that's how I read it. I read it from this more comprehensive, multidimensional standpoint. Because when you do this work on the ground and you're engaged in communities directly and you understand the impact in this dimensional way,
And what you're saying really brings up the question of dehumanization here. But I have to speak the language in this report of 90% of children experiencing this or that in order to reach people for whom me saying it's traumatizing for a person to lose a family member. They can't grasp that necessarily because I'm talking about Palestinians. Yeah. So anyway, just to actually begin with a spotlight on children, since that's an important finding in the report. No age group or gender has been spared, but children under 5 and women, the elderly and the disabled have been especially vulnerable in Gaza. And that is partly in terms of children, because almost half the population of Palestinians in Gaza is under 18. So you hit a building and you're likely to kill children. 9 out of 10 children are not receiving the food they need. 90% of children under 5 were affected by one or more infectious diseases. That's just in the first 120 days of the war. Children have been telling Doctors Without Borders workers that they want to die. These are just tip of the iceberg kind pieces of information that give you a sense of the despair. Wounded Children with No Surviving Family Member, WCNSF, is a new acronym that was coined by medical teams that had to be coined because there were so many of those children, and they're among the most vulnerable individuals in the war. Children between the ages of 6 and 59 months especially are facing a dire nutritional emergency. There's been a dramatic rise in children born with low birth weight and just not surviving the neonatal period at all. These are just some examples in terms of children. Now, in terms of the pathways, one very important one that we are hearing about a little bit more is food insecurity. So that means that people are dying of starvation, but it also means that their immune systems are compromised. So they're more susceptible to infectious diseases and infections. And this is where it's helpful for me to remind our listeners that over 94,000 people are injured. And chronic and non-communicable diseases are rampant, and you become more vulnerable to those when you're also malnourished. The report amplifies a finding that at least 62,000 people are estimated to have died already of starvation. That's just one contributor to the indirect death number. And in total, almost the entire population, 96% of Gaza's population, faces acute food insecurity. There is an extreme lack of access to water. The amount of water accessible to people has been decreased by 94%. And a person has around 4.7 liters a day of water, which is under a third of the recommended minimum in emergencies. And just to give a sense for our listeners, it's under one toilet flush. I think it goes without saying that the economy has been completely eradicated. But just as an example, already in January, 201,000 people had lost their jobs. So no cash means the inability to get medicine, food, and a total dependence on humanitarian aid, which leads us to the point that the entire population is basically dependent on humanitarian aid, and that aid is being almost entirely limited, constrained by Israel. Now, to put a focus partly on northern Gaza, which has been separated off from the south for several months now, we have a total lack of aid going to northern Gaza as part of that extermination process. Again, I couldn't say extermination in my report, but I'm saying it here. Being displaced cuts access to shelter, of course, income, healthcare, family support, of course, as well as exposure to the elements and infection, as well as disease. 90% of Gaza's population has been displaced. So that's pretty much the entire strip's worth of people are displaced and living in shelters, tents, or just out in the open. I think over 80% at this point of buildings and housing structures are damaged or destroyed, and almost all the roads have been damaged or destroyed. And something I mentioned in the report is that while Israel destroys, it also builds. And I think that's a long story any of us who've been following Palestine for years know about. So there's no media attention to the road that Israel has built called the Netzarim Corridor, cutting the north off from the south. Construction for that road began in October of last year and was completed in March. But we're only hearing about it in dribs and drabs when we hear about northern Gaza's isolation now. But it just shows you that this has been part of a plan, clearly, since the beginning of the war. Lack of access to medical care, just the numbers are completely devastating. 5,000 people at least are estimated to have died of non-communicable diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. Most of the upwards of 52,000 women who are pregnant in Gaza as of January have given birth outside of medical facilities. And that means unhygienic conditions and lack of anesthesia. There were at least 350,000 people living with chronic illnesses requiring systematic attention. They are unable to get that attention. For example, cancer treatment has not been available in Gaza since October 2023. Almost all the hospitals have been damaged or destroyed. Almost 900 healthcare workers have been killed. Again, and I say this a little bit cynically, like, why do I have to put things in different terms to try to reach different audiences? But there was only one toilet for 4,130 people in El Mawasi, which is supposedly the safe zone down in southern Gaza, where people have been pushed. And only 10 to 30% of people in Gaza have access to soap. And that is out of date. That's probably fewer at this point. I just want to amplify that a group of 99 American doctors wrote a letter to Biden and Harris in early October. These are all doctors who had served in Gaza in the last year, I think over something like 200 weeks in total. And they reported mass infant deaths, avoidable maternal deaths and stillbirths, C-sections with anesthesia, high infections of C-section incisions, as well as all surgical incisions. And they reported that everyone in Gaza is sick, injured, or both.
If your listeners can really begin to digest the enormity of what Sophia is saying, that would be a great first step. But I would also say that digesting it needs to prepare you that even the results of Sophia's really brilliant analysis, it's probably going to be much worse for a couple of reasons. Number one, there's no end in sight. So that even though we hear political machinations about ceasefires and politicians and State Department officials going and rushing and being very eager to create a ceasefire, the reality on the ground is that there is no ceasefire. And people who have been understanding and looking at this dynamic for many years now, and I'm one of them who actually believes that there will not be a ceasefire, that this pogrom that is being exacted on Palestinians right now in Gaza is going to go full steam ahead. With that being said, we have to take on the real possibility that Sophia's analysis is probably, and I know this may be hard to digest, Sophia, may actually be underestimating the full generational impact. And I'll just say one thing in particular, because there's a lot that's being said about the starvation of Palestinian children in Gaza. And as you rightly point out, half of the population in Gaza is under the age of 18. It's an extremely young population where children's immune systems and central nervous systems and bodies are just not developmentally able to get the nutrients that they need to develop in a normal way. What people don't realize that if you stress a child with malnutrition and starvation, it's not as if you can flip a switch, start feeding them, and that things will all be better. What we know about the long-term impact of starvation on children is that even if they are eventually provided with some basic nutritional supplements and they're able to get their calories and it's nutritionally balanced, that there are long-term consequences that are irrevocable, that can never be turned back in time. So that gives you pause to think about what if there is a ceasefire? What if these food, water, and medicine starts to come in? Will that alleviate some of the profoundly disturbing impacts that are in Sophia's study? And we may have to come to the conclusion, maybe it won't help. Of course, we need to get food, water, and medicine. Of course, we need to rebuild the healthcare infrastructure. But its impact in terms of mitigating and lessening some of these losses may not be as optimistic as some people realize. And I know you mentioned this, Sophia, but the other thing to really, really look at in terms of long-term chronic health implications is the it's the combination of the lack of water, clean water. The water supply has been gone now for over a year, and the water is and has been really polluted and contaminated for a very long time there. One of the things that we noticed working in Gaza over the years is that the amount of renal dysfunction and kidney dysfunction for children and older adults in Gaza is at an extremely high level, even before the war. So now you have the decimation of the sanitation system and of the water system. That impact alone in terms of the long-term downstream health, negative health consequences are going to be extraordinary. It should give us pause. And I think to really reflect on what Israel is doing, what the U.S. government is doing, not just in concert, but with the full backing of our military, as well as our political system that is directing this genocide right now, and its impact. And Sophia said this a bunch of times, you had to write it in such a way that policymakers could digest it. That's true, and it's sad at the same time. But it would be good if the Congress and all the policymakers were to read this report just to begin the process, because as you say, this is what's happening in Gaza, but look at what's happened in Iraq. Look at what happened in Afghanistan after 9/11, the kind of downstream devastating impacts on those communities after 9/11. We're still seeing the impact, as you said, 23 years from now, and it's much worse than any of us even anticipated. Given the enormity and the level of destruction in Gaza, I'm not as optimistic. I'm really not. And people who know me, and David, you know this, I tend to be on the side of optimistic. I tend to really think forward, and we are planning on rebuilding in Gaza. But I see that the task in front of us, based on this research and my own experience on the ground right now, really does give me pause to think about how are we going to take on this task of rebuilding? Because we can rebuild buildings. We can rebuild a hospital. We can rebuild a school, but how do you rebuild psychological, emotional, and medical kind of integrity of people who have been so decimated at every aspect and every level of their core existence? That's a bigger task. That's a generational task. And that's the thing that I'm really pushing on people to take on right now, because you look at Sophia's report and you juxtapose that against some of these generational concerns. It's not just sending aid there and building homes. It's a much more complex, complicated task that will figure into the generational future, as I said earlier.
Right. As I was reading the report, I kept on wondering, how do you calibrate cost? You've drawn all these metrics that are invisibilized, but you brought them out so well. And I thought of sort of a two-part question was, one way of maybe understanding the cost of what's happening now is to look back to 2005. What was happening in Gaza before this, which is also horrible. So one way of looking at it would be this exponential rise in death. And then as Jess was talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, I was thinking about that part in your report when you're talking about the West Bank. You know, what's happening there? So if we could look, if you could both talk a little bit about 2005 to now and then look forward to what's happening on the West Bank and Janine in particular.
I'm really glad you're bringing up the West Bank, because I insisted that we talk about the West Bank, even though the scale seems so much smaller by comparison right now to Gaza, just in terms of appearances, right? And it's been easy for the media to overlook the West Bank in thinking of this war as a much broader phenomenon. The main thing to say here is that we are seeing systematic Israeli aggression in the West Bank, unlike anything we've seen in almost 20 years, although resonant with what people have experienced before 20 years ago. So one of the things we saw was that food insecurity has doubled, which is completely invisible in the media, in the West Bank, up to at least 600,000 people who are food insecure. Infrastructure and medical facilities have been targeted. Israel has targeted those infrastructures. So in Jenin, which is a city I know well because I lived there as part of my research, a relative of the family that I stayed with, who was a surgeon, was shot and killed on his way to his job at the government hospital. And patients have been killed while receiving treatment in hospitals. The West Bank has sustained a huge economic hit from a multitude of factors having to do with Israeli aggression. So in January already, 306,000 people had lost their jobs, which is a third of the total workforce. That means you have families unable to buy food, medicine, et cetera, and becoming more desperate in terms of sustaining themselves where they are. At least 3,300 Palestinians outside of Gaza, so that's largely in the West Bank and also in Jerusalem, have been displaced. And in single events, for example, during an incursion in Jenin, officials there reported that 4,000 people were removed from their homes at gunpoint in a single day. 10,300 people in the West Bank have been arrested. And in terms of the destruction of infrastructures, again, just in one Jenin incursion last month and at the end of August, 80% of the city lost access to water. 70% of the streets and infrastructures like electric wires and sewage pipelines were destroyed and damaged. So I think what we're looking at is a multi-front war that is not only Gaza and now Lebanon, but actually taking place across the territories that Israel has historically controlled, including now additionally through legal mechanisms like the discussion of revoking Israeli citizenship from Palestinians with Israeli citizenship who undertake attacks inside Israel. For example, just the idea of denaturalization is now floating around in the public in a very kind of comfortable way. I want to highlight the fact that the UN Relief and Works Agency, I think 2 days ago now, was banned, I think, and designated as a terrorist organization by Israel, which has massive implications, the likes of which I think we haven't seen, even those of us who've been following in the last year, because that agency provides medical care, education, and social welfare programs for refugees across Gaza, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and in Lebanon. Those are just some examples. They also work in Syria and Jordan. I'm thinking about how these kind of shifts in designation, which are becoming normalized in the United States, where you have the UN coming out as more increasingly controversial as a kind of agency in the US public domain, that is going to permit, I'm afraid, to go with your pessimism, Jess, and maybe I am by nature more pessimistic than you are, but I just think I'm right here too, unfortunately, that these changing designations that are legal and regulatory are also going to pave the way for an even greater course of destruction across the West Bank, where the refugee camps have already been prioritized as military targets for Israel in the last couple of years, where bombings of residential areas, mosques, have become normalized again for the Israeli military. So I think we're really looking at not just Gaza, but the unraveling of Palestinian presence across Palestine, an attempted unraveling of the society by undermining the infrastructures and targeting what sustains life. Yeah, so I'm really concerned.
Yeah, but I think that's part of the intentional project of the settler colonial state that Israel is. From 76 years ago, they have tried to engage in multiple fronts, multiple ways in which they could eliminate indigenous Palestinian presence in historic Palestine. What we're seeing now, and I think as you rightly point out, after October of 2023, that process is accelerating. And the obvious ways that it's accelerating in Gaza are obvious to everybody, with literally extermination and destruction of civil and civic societies as we know it in Gaza. And you are right on to say that in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, and in historic Palestine, where, you know, there are 20% of the Israeli population plus are Palestinians who happen to have Israeli citizenship, who are now being targeted by the Israeli government and denaturalized, as you say it, is a polite way of saying they're really speaking very openly about not only denaturalizing them, but forcing them to leave their homes hundreds of generations in historic Palestine. So this is a project that is accelerating, that has been going on for many decades. And we see the manifestation of that just logarithmically being activated now. Israel is using the current climate of the elections, of the United States' political complicity and denial about the full impact is going full steam ahead. I do want to go back to something you asked, though, David, which I do think is really an important question, which is, what's our metric? What's our kind of starting point to look at how grotesque and how depraved this violence is right now? And when I tell people about what Gaza was like before 2005, people are typically pretty shocked because people may have some sort of romanticized or idyllic notion of what life in Gaza was before 2005. Let's be clear about it. Life in Gaza before 2005 was horrific. Before 2005, 80% of Palestinian children were living on less than $2 a day in terms of just foods, and large numbers of cognitive, emotional, and physical stunting was going on in Gaza before 2005. 80% of Palestinian children before 2005 had symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, insomnia, bedwetting, things like that, which is an extraordinarily high number. When we compare that number to, say, Afghan and Iraqi kids, for example, it's double, triple, and quadruple the number of Afghan and Iraqi children during the height of the bombings and the wars in both of those countries. So it's not as life under occupation before 2005 was. In comparison, you might say it was, in quotes, better. But let's be clear about it. The impact of the occupation, the impact of this project to ethnically cleanse and remove any vestige of Palestinian indigeneity in Palestine continues to have a profound impact well before 2005. One other quick kind of metric. Before 2005, because we do a lot of work on health consequences of occupation, if you look at life expectancy between Israelis and Palestinians, who technically, quote, live on the same land, have access to the same resources, again, theoretically, if you look at life expectancy between Palestinians and Israelis, and again, this is before October of 2023, Palestinians on average lived 10 years less. Then there was a 10-year cost to one's lifespan just by being Palestinian. And I dare say that number, that 10 years, is going to rise dramatically, not just in Gaza, but also in Jerusalem and the West Bank and for Palestinians who are in historic Palestine right now. So I think it's a good question, David, when we think about what are we measuring this against? And I think it's really important for all of our listeners to really understand, yes, things are grim, things are depraved, things are devastating right now, but also leading up to what happened in October, which didn't occur in a vacuum, obviously, things were very desperate and pretty terrible too.
Just to go back to the 76 years and remember some of the techniques that Israel used from early on. I wanted to highlight, since my interest in particular has been infrastructure, that the most well-documented type of destruction in general historically that Israel has enacted has been home demolition. Right. And just to go all the way back to 1947-48 to the Nakba, we know at that time that 500 villages were depopulated and destroyed. Just to put it in terms of destruction, that's about 52,000 homes that were destroyed at that time, just in that moment. And the scale is really interesting to think about because we're looking at many times that for the destruction in Gaza. And then in the period after that, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions gathered statistics on continued home demolitions, and it estimates that another 56,000 homes in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem were demolished and destroyed after 1967 alone. And that is not including the thousands of homes that Israel has bombed and destroyed in Gaza in the five wars that you're talking about, Jess. So I think what that is showing me, and those of us who work on Palestine know this, is that these techniques work, that Israel created Israel. by undertaking these forms of destruction. And that is why we have to be so worried about what's happening today in Gaza, the West Bank, in historic Palestine, and in Lebanon, that this destruction, if it's not prevented by some force that's more powerful than Israel, which is the U.S., it does create facts on the ground that are very difficult to roll back.
Yeah, but I think one of the grim realities that people are waking up to at this point is that the facade of American concern for people in Palestine, nobody buys that anymore, that somehow the American political elite, Democrats and Republicans, of which there is absolutely no difference on the policy in Palestine and allowing Israel to do this, I don't think anybody believes anymore that there are any guardrails that are being directed toward the Israeli military or government right now. In fact, something that I've speculated about and spoken about before, I think, is probably one hypothesis, one theory that's gaining a lot of steam. It's not so much that the American policy is to support Israel no matter what, but rather this is the American policy. The Americans don't have a different policy. It's a fiction from Blinken and Biden and the political elite to when they say, we want peace in the Middle East, we want a two-state solution. They say these words, but the words belie the reality of what the United States is doing in all of historic Palestine. And so we may want to give pause to the idea that somehow, and this is part of the framing, oh, Joe Biden is wringing his hands and Blinken is so concerned about the numbers of Palestinian children who are starving to death. I don't believe it anymore. And I think most people don't believe it anymore. They really see what Israel is doing in Palestine and in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and in Yemen as an American political policy. And so despite the words and the hand-wringing that you see, which probably is for political consumption, really belies a new reality of understanding what the American position is. There is no daylight between the American position and the Israeli position on what is happening in Gaza and in Palestine. And if we look at it from that lens, it really frames things, I think, a little differently for all of us who work on these issues to think about. We really need to recalibrate how we're thinking about America's role in this genocide.
I couldn't agree more. And I think if we add Lebanon to that equation and Iran, at a minimum, we're talking about a U.S. rearrangement of the region in coordination with Israel.
That's the way many of us have been seeing it for a while now. And I think that reality is becoming clearer. And you said this at the beginning, Sophia, when you think about just in 1 year, almost $23 billion in military aid going to Israel to drop 4,000-pound bombs on civilians in Gaza, to send ICBMs to Iran to bomb infrastructure in Iran, what they're doing in Lebanon right now, what they're doing in Yemen. Yemen falls under the radar, too, politically. There is a large fleet of American naval vessels off the coast in Lebanon that are bombing it on a regular, not daily basis. This is pretty typical around election season every 4 years. If you go back historically, the Israelis get really aggressive in terms of extending their destructive aims in historic Palestine every 4 years. It's like clockwork. But we're seeing a heightened sense of that because Americans are really interested in Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, and what's happening with the election. And the Israelis are using it to their advantage, again, to extend this destructive path, not just from Palestine, but as you said, Sophia, and I agree completely, it's the entire region. And I don't think it matters who wins the election. People want to think, isn't this better for the Middle East or not? And I really, this is part of the message that I think we're coming to now, there may not be any legitimate fundamental difference in policy between Democrats and Republicans on the destructive path that's in front of us, not just for Palestine, but for the entire Middle East.
I was just going to add that this puts us in the U.S. in a really horrible position in the sense that it's, as Sophia pointed out in that incredible metric, we're facilitating all of this diplomatically, financially, et cetera. So we have a moral duty to fight this knowing full well that it's impossible, but we have to do it nonetheless. And then we turn to international organizations like the UN, we find they're failing miserably too. So we're constantly thinking of different forms of, I don't want to say resistance, but fighting back dissent on an international frame. I know Jess has to go in about 10 minutes. I want to ask this question because, Sophie, you've spent a lot of time rightly on infrastructure. And one thing that you mentioned was the infrastructure of caregiving. We talked about homes, but let's talk about the domestic, the whole, and this is part of a genocide, is cutting off the ability to reproduce a culture in both metaphysical and physical ways. We know that the UN report recently talking about the targeting of hospitals and medical personnel. We know that Israel has been attacking international aid organizations, et cetera. But this horrible acronym, the WCNSF, Wounded Children Without Surviving Family, this to me was the most heartbreaking. When they're tearing apart the fabric of not just mothers to children, but entire families, neighborhoods, all these things they are purposely trying to destroy, even at the most microscopic level, let's say, aside from these large structural ones, that form of caregiving. So here's my question, and it's a big one. How do we deal with the numbness and shock that comes when you confront phenomena like this? And isn't it better to feel something than nothing? How do you both deal with this in your everyday lives, since you're both so immersed in this data and trying to maybe speak a different language for different purposes, but in our heart of hearts, something is going on. How do you both deal with this?
There's a saying in Arabic, David, bil haraka baraka, which means, and I don't know if you heard that, Sophia, when you were in the West Bank, but what it means is that there's blessing in action, in doing things. And despite the depravity, despite the devastation, despite the fact that all of us who do this work are holding on to profound elements of grief and sadness. And as a Palestinian, I have my own personalized sense of grief, having lost so many colleagues in Gaza that I have worked with for 25 years. I've seen their kids grow up, get married. They're all gone. They're dead. So you have that on one side, but juxtaposed to that, and this is really an important thing for me to say in terms of how we manage and get through this. Having done this for a while, for a minute, as we say in the Bay Area, I've never seen the global solidarity community come together on Palestine like I'm seeing now. Never before. Palestine now, for the first time in 76 years, is now part of the discussion at every aspect of our society in ways that it's never been before. School boards. I just got a call from a friend who was dressing her daughter for Halloween in a watermelon outfit, which was in solidarity with Palestine, and was already getting hateful calls from the school district. But because of the obvious brutality, unvarnished, unveiled brutality, it's forcing the entire world to take notice of what's been happening in Palestine in ways that I've never seen before. And I think discussions and engagement at the global level are happening that have never happened before. And this, to me, really does make me, and I know you, maybe you're a little bit more on the pessimistic side, Sophia, but I remain optimistic about the global solidarity movement that's happening right now. So that's part of what keeps me going.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I would echo a lot of what you said, Jess. The grief is greater, I think, than we could have imagined. And those of us who are watching live Gaza accounts are really faced with carnage of a kind that maybe some of us had never witnessed before. And I think on a fine level, the grief is also among colleagues sometimes or family members who don't speak up or who don't express concern. And you see that the dehumanization is really part of the grief that I think I'm experiencing. On the other hand, I feel similarly that the swell of student interest and commitment to learning and solidarity expressions has been unprecedented in my time in higher education. It's really a beautiful thing. And I'm seeing Palestine show up, as you said, Jess, in spaces that it was never present in before. So they're organized social workers for Palestine and now psychoanalysts for Palestine. And I have an interest in Dubke, for example. And I've noticed that the first ever New York City Dubke Festival is taking place next month. So there are a taking over of spaces and also a proliferation of ways in which Palestine figures in people's imagination and hearts and also processes for becoming political subjects that I think is really enlivening and carries us forward. And I guess the thing to say about my sadness about colleagues, especially who are silent, is that I'm also trying to hold open a space, even though I have so much anger, for letting their process happen slowly if it needs to, because we need to be as embracing as possible to as many people as possible who are on their journeys to realizing what's been happening in Palestine.
That is such a wise formulation, Sophia. I can't thank you both enough for being on the program. You're both going to come back over and over again because you're my deep friends. But thank you so much for your report, Sophia. Thank you so much, Jess, for adding the dimensionality that you always do. Take care.
Thanks again. See you
Thank
guys.
You. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu. And let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.